Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. The pre-med year, session number 504. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Med Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Med Years. My name is Dr. Ryan Gray. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. I have an awesome guest today, Dr. Brian Elliott, who wrote a book all about medical traditions. You'd be surprised where some of our paths have come from. And maybe you won't be surprised. They're not the most, best starts, the most authentic and goodwill starts in this journey. You may be surprised, maybe not, but we have an awesome discussion with Dr. Elliott about his book, White Coat Ways, A History of Medical Traditions and Their Battle with Progress. It is on sale December 2022, or now, if you're listening to this in the future. Before we jump in, though, I want to talk about the MCAT Minutes brought to you by Blueprint MCAT. Did you know that the whole point of this journey is to test you, to make sure that you can handle what's to come in medical school, in residency, and everything else? And one of those ways of testing you is to see if you can juggle classwork, extracurricular activities, MCAT prep, all of that fun stuff. And one of the best ways to make sure that you're ready for that MCAT prep is to plan your work. Use the free study planner tool from Blueprint MCAT to help you with that planning. Again, that's blueprintmcat.com. Use their free study planner tool to plan out your study plan based on your specific individual needs, how much work you have, how much family time you have, whatever that may be. Again, that's blueprintmcat.com. Sign up for a free account, get free access to their study planner tool. All right, let's jump in and say hello to Dr. Elliott. Brian, welcome to the pre-med years. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to chat with you about your book, White Coat Ways, A History of Medical Traditions and Their Battle with Progress. I love that little subheader. I forget what they call that in the book world. I've written lots of books. What do you call that little extra thing? Subtitle?
The long title or the running title.
The running title, subtitle, whatever it is. The Battle with Progress, because I'm sure potentially you would agree that medicine is a very conservative field, and sometimes that's not a good thing. And so I'm interested to see what you have to say. Before we jump in, though, when did you first realize that you wanted to be a physician?
Well, it's going way back now. It definitely didn't start that way.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't come into college thinking that I wanted to do medicine. I started wanting to do physical therapy.
Yeah.
And so I started taking classes in physiology and everything like that. And I just loved it. And I wanted more of it. And I saw medicine as the perfect way to just get as much medicine as I could and continue to do that.
Yeah.
As I continue on.
So there was a little bit of a switch from like, I like physical therapy, I like what I'm learning, but it's not going to be enough. And so I need to keep going.
Yeah, it was, I wanted more than just, you know, more musculoskeletal things. I wanted cardiac and all the other systems, and I wanted to really dive in.
Yeah. So very similar to my story, I realized in high school, though, because I went down the physical therapy route, shadowing a physical therapist in high school, and then I cut open a cat in my senior level or senior year biology class, and I was like, ooh, I want to cut things for a living. So I made the switch very quickly to orthopedic surgery as my dream career, although as we were just discussing, the Air Force had other plans for me, which is okay, because I wouldn't be here probably if I went down that other route. So you go down the medicine route, you realize, ooh, I want more knowledge, I want more impact. What was the hardest part about being a pre-med, do you think, for you?
I think the competition really gets to you. I think there's a lot of stress that we put on ourselves. You know, I got to do this, and I got to crush the MCAT, and I got to do my applications right, write a beautiful personal statement. And sometimes you forget to stop and smell the roses.
Yeah. Do you think that's perceived expectations, or do you think those expectations are real?
I think a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the person too, but I definitely think a little bit of both. The system is certainly designed for that competition, but even after you get into med school and you get into residency, people often find themselves just putting their head down.
Head down doing what?
Not stopping to smell the roses, not enjoying what yeah. they're doing.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to publish. I got to do this. I got to do this.
It never stops. There's always more to do. I was just having a discussion earlier with another student for an episode earlier. And we had this discussion. I've been talking about it a lot, is the intentionality of this process and the mindset of, my goal is to be an attending physician, right? And that's only the goal. And every single day leading up to that is just a slog leading up to the goal versus waking up. And as you said, right, stopping to smell the roses, just appreciating every day is a win, a goal all by itself. All of the tests and all of the activities and all of the just everything you have to do to get through this process. I don't think enough people take those small wins and victories and applaud themselves and give themselves credit. They only look at 3 more years until I'm attending, 2 more years until I'm attending, 1 more. And that's all they think about.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think that's spot on. Is people are so focused on what's ahead, they're not thinking about what's going on now and not enjoying it.
Yeah. So I'm interested to talk to you because at some point along your journey, you stopped to smell the roses and ask a lot of questions. I want to talk about what led you down this path of researching medicine and the history of this world to be able to write a book. Were you always an inquisitive person?
I've definitely always been an inquisitive person. I'm the person who keeps asking why and won't stop until they understand.
You were that toddler.
Yes. And still am that person. Yeah. My toddler luckily hasn't reached that phase yet, but I'm still that person deep down.
Yeah. And so what were those questions for you that led you down this rabbit hole?
Well, it started in med school, and I didn't set out saying, I'm going to write a book about this. I went through the white coat ceremony and the Hippocratic Oath and all the things that we do in medical school. And I was like, why? Where did this come from? This thing's 3,000 years old.
Yeah.
Should we really be, you know, using it as our creed? So I just really looked into those traditions. And then I was like, wow, this is fascinating. I had no idea that the thing I just swore to actually said this. So I thought, you know, maybe I'll write an article, and then an article turned into a really long article. And then that eventually turned into, okay, there's a lot more, and there's a lot more traditions. So I took the 7 most common and then turned it into a book.
Very interesting. I just want to say for everyone, this is a common misconception. First, do no harm is not in the Hippocratic Oath.
Mm-mm.
Where did that myth come from? Did you research that?
Yeah, so that actually comes from Of the Epidemics, which is a a separate thing written in the Hippocratic corpus, which is this body of work that we attribute to the Hippocratic physicians. And by the way, there were many, probably. The Hippocratic corpus wasn't just written by one guy, or at least that's what most scholars agree on. Mm. Whereas the Hippocratic oath likely wasn't written by any of them, not even a Hippocratic physician. And that's a common misconception. So do no harm actually is more related to Hippocrates than the actual Hippocratic oath.
Interesting. So why do we call the Hippocratic oath the Hippocratic oath?
Because it sounds nice.
Because it's cooler. And we could say Hippocrates, the father of medicine.
Exactly. Well, and we don't know for certain. No one can say this is who wrote it. But when scholars look at the content of the initial Hippocratic Oath, it's a lot more in line with some other beliefs from other sects of medicine at the time. So it's more believed to be related to Pythagoras and his followers.
Yeah. How much, I'm wondering, as you were doing your research, it was just a headline I saw the other day, and I don't remember where, about like some super ancient old civilization. And they're like, they probably knew a lot more about medicine and how our bodies worked and taking care of bodies and doing surgeries on our bodies than we assumed. Like how much digging, like you talk about these old dudes doing medicine. Like, what did that look like back then?
Well, it depends what time frame. I focus mostly on Hippocrates and after, which is really not even the true beginning. Like you said, I mean, even the Egyptians did what we now do is called burr holes, where they drill a hole into the cranium to drain blood from the surrounding outside the brain. And there's evidence that even the Egyptians did something similar back in the day. So they had a surprisingly impressive knowledge of medicine sometimes. At other times, it's wild the harmful things that they did. It really goes both ways. Yeah. But even reading, you know, Galen, who was a Roman physician way back when, I could read what he wrote in Anatomy and understand what he meant, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Let's talk about some of those harmful things and dive a little bit into the MDDO world. I always get a little hyperbolic when I talk about the start of the DO world with A.T. Still sitting in his med school classroom going, why are we bloodletting people? Like, it's the 1890s or whatever year it was. We need better ways, and I'm going to go make this new career field. How much research did you do into the start of the whole DO philosophy?
Oh, quite a lot. And one chapter specifically focuses on MDs and DOs and where they both come from and maybe even where they're going next.
Yeah.
But and to clarify, if I speak negatively about DOs or MDs, back, I'm talking about old school, like 1800s, not contemporary, obviously. But yeah, some of the things that they did were very interesting. And like you said, A.T. Still kind of went rogue. It actually happened after his kids died, which is totally reasonable. So he had three children that died of meningitis. And then he invited a doctor to come help treat them along the way. And when that doctor failed, he's like, I don't believe this. You're not effective. Yeah. Which is not an unreasonable thing. They weren't very effective back then. I mean, they didn't have antibiotics for meningitis. So he came up with his own ideology, which was that the seed of disease was really in the spine and some other concepts that go along with that.
Yeah. Where did he go from there? Talk about that journey.
Well, to fame and fortune is the short answer. He basically took that ideology and started his own school in Missouri.
Yeah.
And he was such a charismatic person that people really listened. And this was an era where medicine wasn't the scientific method all around. I mean, there were so many different types of physicians. There were homeopaths, eclectics, osteopathy.
And the year of this is like late 1800s, correct?
Yeah. So his school, I want to say, chartered in 1891.
Yeah.
And he quickly got traction and got about 700 medical students by the turn of the century.
Wow. And so he found this fame and fortune, as you said, maybe for good reasons, maybe for not so good reasons. Is there a lot of history behind, like, was he super altruistic, or was this a play to get famous?
I wouldn't describe him as altruistic.
Oh, no.
I think he believed what he was doing.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong, he wasn't living modestly by any means.
Okay.
But him and D.D. Palmer, who founded chiropractic around the same time, are very interesting because, you know, all these medical organizations were more, I don't want to say culty, but they were kind of a little bit, you know. Yeah. It was, they idolized their one leader and they had this set of beliefs. It was basing medicine on an ideology and not how we do it today. We base it on a methodology. We base it on the scientific method. We do randomized controlled trials and studies, and that's going to show us what's true and what's effective.
Yeah.
Whereas back then it's, you know,
I believe
this is the seed of disease. I believe in this guy because
I read some stones and this is what they told me.
that's exactly true. And even mainstream, you know, traditional MDs, they were just getting into that scientific revolution. So,
yeah,
like I said, they weren't doing the right things then either.
Yeah, let's talk about the MD world, because even then there was still a lot of, I believe, and here's what I saw in a dream, and here's why I think I'm going to slit your neck open and bloodlet you for a little bit. Where did kind of modern medicine start for the MD world?
Well, it was at the same time the MDs were fighting with A.T. Still and D.D. Palmer, but they were also fighting with themselves.
Yeah.
So
it's basically like modern times.
Yeah.
It's no different.
Similar. We're a bit better now, though. They had the same transition at the turn of the century. So in 1910 was when the Flexner Report came out. And even before that, there were tons of licensing rules that started to go into play to cut out all the low-tier physicians at the time who were really terrible at their job.
Yeah.
Because medical school back then was whatever you wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could go to medical school and graduate in 6 months because there was no regulation, and professors knew that if they started a medical school, they could get money from students. So it was a ton of for-profit medical schools churning out low-tier physicians, and it wasn't until they trimmed out those low-tier physicians at the early 1900s that changed.
And so just for someone who doesn't know the Flexner Report, talk about that. This big report that came out that basically was like, we need to do better at training doctors here.
Yes. Yeah. So it started with licensing, and the ACG was founded around the same time too. And they put forth rules. A medical school has to be 3 years long. It has to have anatomy. It has to have physiology and et cetera. And state by state started to say, if you don't do these things, you can't practice medicine.
Okay.
And that started to chip away at some of them. Some of them couldn't keep up because they were for-profit organizations that relied on tuition, and that long of schooling prevented students from coming and paying a bunch of money. So some of them started to chip away. The others said, well, we kind of have an anatomy lab. We have one cadaver. So
it's 20 years old.
It's 20 years old. We have 100 students, but it works. And in 1910, Abraham Flexner, who was a big med ed guy, toured the country and he visited 155 medical schools, and he trashed them. Trashed nearly all of them. And he said, these are money making machines. We don't like these. And he praised only a handful. He wanted to cut them down to about 30 medical schools, which was too radical.
So I'm a big skeptic. And mm-hmm. we talk about, like, we were talking about A.T. Still. Was it altruistic? Was it not? Like, there's something in me that goes, well, Flexner and ACGME and all them, they just wanted all the money to themselves, and they didn't want all of these other people. So if you wanted to be a real medical school, you have to pay us to be accredited. In your research, did you find any sort of like mob-like behavior from that angle?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Just like No one was really altruistic in this journey.
Of course not.
Because what they were essentially arguing for was a monopoly.
Of course.
They said, we want to be the only provider.
Yeah. And guess what? It worked.
It did. The interesting thing is, you know, who survived that monopoly? And osteopathic medicine is one of them.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of antitrust lawsuits, one from chiropractic about 50 years ago, saying they can't do this. They can't be the only providers out there. But while it did push quite a bit of a monopoly, it also converted osteopathic medicine to what it is today, which is scientifically based.
Mm. Yeah. So I was reading Cultish. Have you read that book, Cultish?
I have not. No.
It's good. I'm about halfway through. I need to pick it back up. But it's a book about cults and kind of how they start. And a lot of what we consider kind of standard run of the mill stuff these days started in a very cult like fashion. Like an A.T. Still, who's a very charismatic guy, going, "Hey, come follow me. I know the way." And for the first few whiles, the population is like, "Who's this quack over here?" And who are these followers? Right, the very common language that we use for cults. And after a while, it's like, "Oh, yeah, that's the osteopathic world." And obviously that was 200 years ago, and we are in a very different place now with osteopathic physicians being right up there with allopathic physicians, and allopathic world starting in a very similar way of you get a few charismatic people that kind of lead the way. It's crazy when you go back anything in our history, when you go back and look, it's like, "Oh, I'm glad it kind of got to where it is now. But those were some weird beginnings."
Yeah, I mean, those were the times. You know, you had somebody down the street preaching something that sounded awesome and had these great results that they were talking about. And you were like, yeah, there wasn't Google. You couldn't Google and see what was going on. So that's how things started. That sounds like a great book, though. I love the Netflix documentaries on cults that they always put out.
Yeah, they're fun. So it's funny. I think about kind of where our world is today with social media and as much kind of the internet and how everything is so public and information travels so fast. And we look at, obviously, with the pandemic these last 2 years, you have these frontline doctors, the frontline healthcare, whatever their name is, pushing ivermectin and doing this. I'm like, well, who's to say in 200 years that we don't look back and go, "Oh, there's this whole new breed of medicine out there that they started," and everyone was like, "Who are these quacks?" And so I kind of always think about that in the back of my mind, going, "Should we label them this easily? Should we not?" What are your thoughts looking forward as you kind of talk about progress and everything in your book as well?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. But the difference is, you wait until the science and there's plenty of randomized controlled trials showing that those things don't work.
Yeah.
But certainly that we need a little bit of fringe provider to push forward things that eventually do work. Mm. Like when the Dix Hall Pike and Epley maneuvers were first made, those motions that we do with patients to move the otoliths, the stones in their ears for vertigo, people were like, "What are you doing? You can't just manipulate somebody's head and treat their vertigo." But clearly that showed to be helpful, and that's why we still do it. So it's really about waiting until you see what the science says and then following the science.
Yeah.
And not just following people who tout things for their own benefit.
Yeah. I mean, we needed the guy to swallow H. pylori to prove his point that it's like, there's something causing these ulcers down here.
Yeah, that's why medical history is so fascinating. The things that people did to themselves, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. What was the most interesting thing you found along your research?
Ooh, that's a good question. There's a lot of different ones. I'd have to choose between the most commonplace misconception that I saw was the Hippocratic Oath. That one was fascinating to me. The most ridiculous thing that I saw was John Brinkley. So he was a quote physician, which was self-attributed, around the same time of A.T. Still and D.D. Palmer. And he felt that he could treat low testosterone by implanting goat testicles into his patients. Yeah.
Yep. Like, what's better than two testicles? Four. Here you go.
Yep. No, a patient came to him and was like, you know, I'm having these issues. And he's like, well, you wouldn't have these issues if you had goat testicles. And the patient was like, yeah, you're right. Let's give it a shot. Sold. And even paid him. He's like, here, take my money. Put him in.
And what happened to this patient? Do we know?
So John Brinkley said that it worked fantastically.
Of course he said.
Yeah, which
I wrote up a case report.
Which biologically does not make any sense, but...
Yeah, like... And why goats? I mean, when I think of like manly testosterone laden animals, goats don't come top of mind.
Yeah, it's what he had. That's the short answer.
It's what he had access to castrate.
Yep.
Oh, that's very interesting. And where did he put them? Like, did he like do a scrotectomy, like a scrototomy, and open up a and like, oh, that's just weird.
Yep.
I mean, logically, you go, like, why? We do a lot of xenographic Grass. Kind of pig valves and this and that. Like, why not? Let's try it. I'm glad he tried it, but I would love to see current data on whether or not, right, instead of rubbing testosterone cream on my skin to get testosterone, if just some bull testicles, right? We eat Rocky Mountain oysters. Why not implant them and see how it works?
You give it a shot. I mean,
do you think an IRB would sign off on
waiting
that?
For the science. Yeah, I was going to say, I'd like to be at that IRB meeting that reviews the ethics.
That's very interesting. That's the fun thing about science, especially when you think about in the past, when we were a little bit more loose with science. And obviously, some bad stuff happened. Did you do any research into some of the bad things like Tuskegee and stuff like that?
I didn't go into Tuskegee in this one, but what actually is pretty pertinent is the chapter on the Hippocratic Oath goes into the Nazis and some of the horrible things that they did. I mean, they would just freeze people and rewarm them and experiment with that. And that bred the Declaration of Geneva, which came right afterwards, which was one of the many iterations of oaths and creeds that physicians tried.
Horrible atrocities. So that's interesting. So some goat testicles and some Hippocratic Oath attribution. That's interesting. What about our white coat ceremony? Why is the white coat a thing? And nowadays, everyone gets a white coat. It's not even doctors anymore. Nurses and pharmacists and everyone gets a white coat. So where did that tradition come from? Why do we still do it? Even though we have data that shows that white coats are these German-laden, gross pieces of clothing that we wear.
And that's the biggest irony of it, is that they're germ-laden, like you said, but they were founded for antisepsis. Yeah, right? Which is fascinating. And it goes all the way back to Lister, Joseph Lister, who was a physician in Europe, who initially started saying, you know, if we decrease the germs, then the infections for surgical sites will go down. And it goes a lot into that. And then over time, also at the end of the 1800s, there was a movement. There were a few early photos from Mass General and the Agnew Clinic in Philadelphia that show surgeons really were the ones to start wearing white coats. And things got kind of caught on from there. There's a little bit more detail to it, but lately we've flipped this. So now the white coat ceremony is all about humanism. And that was a good transition that happened just a couple of decades ago and fairly recent. But we've kind of taken that initial meaning of being antisepsis, and we know it's not true, so we just kind of change it up a little bit.
Yeah, we still want to do it. Let's not change tradition. Let's just kind of rework it to make it logical nowadays. That's perfect. That's
one of the themes there.
As human we'll psychology.
Adjust it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Europe's pretty interesting because some parts have a bare below the elbows policy.
Yeah.
So you can't wear sleeves.
Yeah.
And
no ties, sleeves.
Yeah.
And it's
no
like
jewelry, like watches.
Why not? And I get frustrated. It's one of my most frustrating aspects. I don't practice medicine anymore, but my wife still practices, and she talks a lot about these things. And I'm like, well, why? Right? Why do we do that? Well, and most of the time it's, well, that's just because we are doctors and we are held to a higher standard, and this is what patients expect, and this is how we're supposed to present ourselves. And I think it's just a bunch of BS. Like, we're out there doing some amazing work as doctors, but like to put ourselves up on a pedestal to say we have to wear this uniform that we know is not good for people just so that we can show people, hey, look at me, I'm in a white coat. I don't understand. And so the battle with progress, as your kind of subtitle says, how are we going to proceed forward in our medical world?
Yeah. I mean, well, you just accurately summed up the passion that drove me to write this book is why are we still doing some of these things? And don't get me wrong. I'm not against all traditions. You know, I love Christmas trees and I love, you know, some of the traditions around holidays, but those don't impact patients.
Yeah.
And white coats do. And what you find is that people get so attached to the status quo. Some of the backlash that happened in Europe when they cut out white coats for the bare below the elbows policy is just crazy, crazy. The vehement things that they had to say to rail against it is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Mayo, I don't know if Mayo came up in your world, but Mayo doesn't do a white coat ceremony, correct? They don't believe in that tradition of white coats. Did you do any research on that?
No, I didn't happen to see that. I would be very interested to hear why and when that changed.
I looked it up recently, and I forget already what the reasons were, but I don't think it was for a cleanliness thing. I think it was more for and something I truly believe in. Actually, I remember that it's a barrier. A psychological barrier between the doctor and the patient. And so when you go in and you're wearing your white coat, they automatically, the patient automatically is like, ooh, you are better than me. You know more than me. And feels at a lower level. And potentially they're thinking, and something I heard a long time ago when I first started practicing, it puts them at a different level psychologically, that they're not comfortable sharing things. They're not comfortable saying, I don't understand what you just told me. Can you repeat it? And so I'm pretty sure that's why they don't do white coats as part of their kind of tradition at Mayo. It was something that when I was in the military, when I was practicing medicine, and the military is obviously a little bit different in terms of that patient-doctor relationship, especially as a flight surgeon, I would introduce myself by first name. And I did that specifically for that same reason of if I go in and say, hey, I'm Dr. Gray, you're automatically putting yourself at another level. And I want them to try to see me as a peer and a partner in this process of healthcare. And I understand from obviously my wife being a physician, from lots of friends who are women physicians, and that whole kind of experience in the from a woman's point of view of like, well, they don't even believe I'm a doctor because I'm a woman, and so they introduce themselves as doctor. I'm perfectly okay with that, right? Just understanding that perspective as well.
Yeah, and I think Mayo makes a great point there too, because psychiatry and pediatrics especially have gone away from the white coat for that reason, is that it's standoffish, a little paternalistic to the patient, that you represent the establishment and I don't want to give all my information away to the establishment. And there are some studies about how patients perceive it too. And, you know, unfortunately those studies also show that there is a gender bias, which is definitely something to consider in this.
Yeah.
The other thing I'd say too is that for the people who do ditch the white coat, your classic Patagonia jacket, the new white coat, is still covered with germs.
It's still covered with germs. Yeah. It's the fact that you're wearing something every day, all day, And not washing it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where we forget the original point. The point was to be clean.
Yeah.
And we're forgetting that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see surgeons wearing it. Like, I just was in a brutal surgery where there was, of course, only like 100 cc's of blood loss because that's all there ever is. But the surgeon's covered in blood and whatever. And they put on their white coat to like cover it up and be clean. That I mean, logically makes sense. Like, let me cover it up so it's not scary for someone to see me covered in blood, whatever.
They used to love that and actually accumulate it intentionally. So when they first did those surgeries, they had a smock that they didn't change at all, especially not between surgeries, that accumulated a good surgical stink.
That's gross. That's very gross. Yeah. So let's talk about more progress stuff here. Going back to kind of that white coat and the establishment angle, we're in a period of time now with the pandemic where anti-science, anti-expert, anti-physician, anti-vaccine, anti-everything is kind of the fun soup of the day. How do we, whether it's some of our own kind of history and traditions that are keeping us from having better connections with our future patients, how do we get more progress here?
Oof, if I could answer that question, I would be way higher up than I am right now, because that is an existential question that is healthcare's issue right now.
Yeah,
I think part of it is being real and transparent with the patients, and you know, certainly appreciating their point of view, because if you look at it from a historical side, there are a lot of reasons to doubt mainstream medicine. I mean, like we were just talking about, there are some bad things that we've done. We certainly don't do those things anymore, but I think just being transparent with what we're doing and why we're doing it is a good start.
Yeah. And as you said, right, understanding their point of view, I think we too often, I get very mad when I see doctors flouting their, my medical degree is better than your Dr. Google or whatever the saying is about Dr. Google. And I actually wrote an article about it a while ago. Like, we shouldn't put patients down for Googling their symptoms and coming to us with, hey, this is what WebMD says. Hey, this is what whatever says. We have to be okay with them coming in, doing their own research, because that's what they're going to do. We have to keep those lines of communication open and having empathy into their frustration, into the system, into their fear about what they may have based on what they read on the internet. We have to be empathetic to that, or else we're just going to continue to drive a wedge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And you know, back in the day, they were intentionally shrouding medical knowledge. They were naming everything in Latin to torture medical students and keep patients a little bit in the dark. And it worked for them because they were paternalistic. But this is the 21st century, and we have things like Google and a lot of online resources, and we should use them to our advantage.
Yeah. So when you think about the audience listening to this, going to be a lot of pre-med students, what do you hope they get out of reading your book?
I hope they look at the things that they're going to see along the way, and they also ask why and make sure that they get a good answer for it. Because to me, just because we've always done it that way is not a good reason for doing things in healthcare.
All right. There you have it. Dr. Brian Elliott, author of White Coat Ways, A History of Medical Traditions and Their Battle with Progress. A great discussion with Brian about where we've come from, and hopefully where we're going. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to check out blueprintmcat.com. Sign up for that free account. Get access to that study planner tool. Have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.